I'm Shamita Basu, in for Tanzina Vega. It's been more than a century since the influenza pandemic of 1918. That's the deadliest pandemic in recent history, with at least 50 million deaths worldwide. And although many things have changed in the years since, the historic pandemic offers some lessons for today, especially right now, as more states relax their social distancing measures put in place because of COVID-19. For more on this, we turn to Alex Navarro, the assistant director of the Center for the History of Medicine at the University of Michigan.
There were four waves of the disease. Some say three, and depends on how you count them. There was a spring of 1918 wave that was not very deadly. Then there was the deadly fall wave that started in really late August in the military camps and then into early September in the Northeast. And then it spread out across the country from there, and it hit other cities, usually end of September, early October. It lasted through the fall, and then there was another wave right on the heels of that wave in the winter of 1919. And in some cities, those two waves sort of merged as one in some ways. And then there was another wave in the winter of 1920.
Ooh, all right. That's a lot of waves. So I know that some U.S. cities decided to put in place some social distancing measures. Were those measures similar to the social distancing measures we're seeing now?
They weren't quite as sweeping, generally speaking. Most places, but not all cities, closed schools. And they also tended to close places of public amusement. So things like movie theaters, performance theaters, pool halls, dance halls. They oftentimes closed, or at least recommended, the closure of churches. And they would oftentimes, but not always, close saloons. And they would have gathering bans, sometimes applying only to indoor gathering bans, and also sometimes applying to outdoor bans as well. And that was generally the level of closure order. So they weren't as sweeping as today with the stay-at-home orders and with a more sweeping closure of all non-essential businesses.
And you're saying they were deciding to close this and they were deciding to close that. Is that the federal government in that case, or were those decisions being made on the state level or even lower down municipality, county level?
Right. So those decisions were all made at the local or state level, depending on how those public health offices operated. There were plenty of states that issued statewide closure orders. Some of them recommended closure orders and allowed the final decision to be left with the local municipalities. There really was not a very strong federal response. Public health was and still remains the domain of states and local governments. The United States was at war at the time, so President Wilson was supremely involved in making sure that mobilization continued. He was already looking to the post-World War I world with the League of Nations and that sort of thing. The federal response was largely relegated to controlling the epidemic in the military camps, and there were a handful of circulars that went out throughout the fall from the United States Public Health Service, as well as the Surgeon General's office, saying, okay, this is what you should be on the lookout for. This is what influenza looks like, making posters so that people knew not to cough and sneeze into their hand, but to use a handkerchief. And the Public Health Service did recommend that cities and states at least consider these types of gathering bans and closure orders as a way of helping to control the epidemic. But that was essentially the federal response.
How long were those closure orders and those social distancing guidelines in place?
It varied from community to community, and typically it was about 3 to 5 weeks or so was about the average, and it depended on how the epidemic was unfolding in each community. Most cities outside of the Northeast in particular, when they removed, they thought they were coming down the other side of the curve and their epidemics were over, and they removed those social distancing orders and those gathering bans too soon, and they faced a second spike of cases. And in some cities, that second spike was actually higher than the first.
And what else did they do beside banning large gatherings and putting these social distancing guidelines into place?
So in a handful of cities, they also implemented mandatory masking orders. In some cities, they were recommended, but in the West Coast, in, for example, Denver, Seattle, Oakland, San Francisco, they mandated that masks be worn. And that was met with a great deal of opposition, particularly in San Francisco. They often allowed people to make homemade masks out of any number of materials. As cotton gauze became scarce, they recommended using linen in San Francisco to entice women in particular to wear masks. They said you can make them out of chiffon. So the type of material didn't really matter. It was more as long as you're covering your face with something. And people got quite creative. They wanted to be able to smoke and wear a mask at the same time, so they would stitch a little flap over the mouth or all sorts of things like that.
Yeah, and we've been seeing protests pop up around the country right now against different stay-at-home orders in various states and the wearing of face masks today. I mean, can you tell me a little bit more about public perception in 1918? It sounds like you're saying a lot of people didn't like wearing their face masks, but other than that, how did people view the outbreak and their personal responsibility in it?
It's a little bit hard to judge that through just the newspaper reporting, you know, from 100 years ago. But what we can say is that, generally speaking, there seemed to be fairly widespread compliance. Sometimes business owners did gripe, but in a lot of places they realized that, you know, if you're a theater owner and there's an epidemic going on, that people aren't going to buy tickets anyway. And so initially, at least, there was a great push to try and control the epidemic as much as possible and to get through that crisis as quickly as possible. And you also have to remember, this is a time of war. And so there's a lot of patriotic nationalism running through society, and people really want to feel like they're doing their part on the home front. That starts to wane, however, you know, within 3 to 5 weeks these orders last. As people start to hear the reports that cases and deaths are on a decline, they think the epidemic is over. They don't realize that these orders, these social distancing orders, are just flattening the curve and bending it around the other side, and that the disease is still out there. And so, you know, we start to see in most of these cities at least some pressure, if not high levels of grumbling, to reopen the city and get back to life as normal. And then after, of course, November 11th, when you have the Armistice Day and the end of the war, I think that's really, like in the case of San Francisco, why you see such widespread opposition, because you no longer have that patriotic drive to do what's right for society. People are just tired of living under the restrictions of wartime and then under the restrictions of the epidemic, and they want to return to life as normal.
So there were many different approaches to the flu pandemic in 1918, all across the U.S., even down to different cities having different approaches. Are there specific cities or states that responded especially well?
There are a handful of cities that really got it right. They had a very quick, what we call a public health response time. So they implemented these closure orders very quickly before or right around the time that their epidemics hit the acceleration phase. Other cities like San Francisco, for example, did not. They had a very delayed response, 10, 11 days before they implemented these closure orders and these gathering bans. You know, some cities had very forceful public health leaders. St. Louis is a great example, with Max Starkloff, who was very willing to gather and accept the best data of the day and to change his mind as more data came in. Initially, he was not for closure orders, but when he realized the epidemic was in the city, he changed gears.
Yeah, maybe you can tell us which cities serve as a cautionary tale.
One would be Denver. Denver removed their closure orders and gathering bans right on Armistice Day, November 11th. A lot of cities did that. And they thought that their epidemic was over. And of course, now it's Armistice Day. Everyone is celebrating the end of the war, as well as what they think is the end of the epidemic and the end of these closure orders. And everyone crowds downtown, and they go to theaters, and there are lines out the doors, and they go to auditoriums, et cetera. And within a matter of days, cases and then subsequently deaths start to increase, and quite dramatically. Mm. Denver implemented for just a few hours a second closure order. But it was so unpopular.
Did you say for a few hours?
Yes. Literally just for an afternoon. It was so unpopular with business leaders, especially theater owners. They marched down to City Hall and they demanded that it be rescinded. And to placate them, the health officer and the mayor removed that order and they implemented a mandatory mask order instead. And of course, masks were made out of gauze. They were very porous. And if you're not going to implement a mask order alongside social distancing orders, they weren't all that helpful. They may have helped a little bit, but probably not that much. San Francisco is another great example. San Francisco does something similar. They had a first mask order that came right at the end of their closure order period. They lifted all the orders together, and the masks were not very popular. People didn't like wearing them. They lift their orders. People go back to life as normal, and they see another spike of cases and deaths. And that increased quite significantly. And by early January of 1919, they realized they needed to do something. So they implemented a mandatory mask order, but they didn't implement any other closure orders. That second mask order was met with widespread opposition. There were numerous reports of people being arrested for not wearing their masks and being fined. There was a group that was formed in opposition called the Anti-Mask League. At least 2,000 people at one point met in an auditorium in the city to protest the wearing of masks and this new ordinance. One of the members of the Anti-Mask League was, in fact, also a member of the city's Board of Supervisors, so the county and the city legislative body. And there were many prominent physicians who also were on the Anti-Mask League who didn't believe that masks worked, and along with others, believed that it was an infringement on their civil liberties.
Now, of course, the healthcare infrastructure was so different back then. What did the 1918 pandemic do to the nation's hospitals?
Completely overran them. In just about every city, hospitals were completely swamped with cases very quickly. This was an incredibly explosive disease. Influenza was not a mandatory reportable disease at the start of the epidemic in any city, meaning that physicians were not required to report cases to local health authorities, and therefore the health officers really had no idea how many cases they had. Now, that changed early on in pretty much every city. They made it a reportable disease. But early on, they have no idea how many cases are out there. And so then suddenly they're faced with this onslaught of cases. There's a lack of physicians and nurses because most of them are serving for the war effort either in American military camps on the outskirts of cities or overseas. You know, there's this mass number of cases, temporary hospitals and field hospitals that needed to be erected in most communities. They needed to shuttle non-critical patients to other hospitals and make space for influenza patients and pneumonia patients in some of the larger city hospitals. And healthcare was far more rudimentary than we have today. Although this was germ theory, they understood how influenza spread. They thought it was bacterial and not a viral disease. They didn't realize that for another decade.
So how did the 1918 pandemic finally end?
Well, by that time, they were keeping track of the cases and the deaths, although it was not perfect. They had a pretty good sense of it. And they could track and plot the epidemic curve. And it basically ended because, as we know now, influenza becomes a seasonal phenomena. There are some years that are worse than others. And then we get these epidemic strains that are far more deadly, generally speaking. And in 1918, we had that very deadly fall wave. And then each subsequent wave, as more and more people got sick and recovered, each subsequent wave attenuated and that peak got lower and lower until the H1N1, which was the strain that was circulating, became one of the seasonal influenza strains that circulated for the next couple of decades.
So as we're seeing more states starting to reopen right now, what are some lessons that they should look back to the 1918 pandemic and try and learn from?
You know, given, of course, that the historical context is different, this is 100 years later, but also that perhaps human nature doesn't change all that much, I think one of the lessons is that closure orders and these gathering bans are very difficult to reimplement a second time after they're removed. And that was certainly the case in 1918. You know, the will to issue those orders largely evaporated, with the possible exception of school closures, which did happen in many communities the second time around. There really just wasn't the will to enter into those more sweeping closure orders and gathering bans. And so you see things like face mask orders alone, or they would reduce capacity in theaters. But that was about it, you know, as the epidemic rolled on. And I think many people and even public health officers became resigned to the fact that the epidemic and therefore cases and deaths would simply continue to run its course and that there wasn't a whole lot that could be done. So I think that's one of the lessons. We need to be very careful when lifting these orders, because if we have to remove them or have to implement them rather a second time around, it can be very difficult. And so we definitely need something to replace that community mitigation effort, or I think we're going to be in trouble. The other lesson is to be very careful about what lessons we actually draw from 1918. And I've seen a lot of social media posts about how closure orders in 1918 were not as sweeping as today and that they were shorter and, you know, that they managed to get through the epidemic all the same. And of course, they did get through the epidemic, but it was with a staggering loss of life. And I think if cities had enacted stricter measures and had kept them in place for longer, I think they undoubtedly would have had better outcomes. So the other lesson is to not do what they did in 1918. The lesson is to do better than they did in 1918.
Alex Navarro is the assistant director of the Center for the History of Medicine at the University of Michigan. Alex, thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
At Radiolab, we love nothing more than nerding out about science, neuroscience, chemistry.
But we do also like to get into other kinds of stories. Stories about policing or
politics,
country music,
hockey,
sex of bugs.
Regardless of whether we're looking at science or not science, we bring a rigorous curiosity to get you the answers.
And hopefully make you see the world anew.
Radiolab, adventures on the edge of what we think we know.
Wherever you get your podcasts.